Welcome back to the Dialogue Studio. This podcast series is hosted by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. In it, we explore the transformational practice of dialogue and why it is important, especially in this current moment. In these episodes, you will hear from individuals from all walks of life sharing what dialogue means to them and how they are practicing it in their daily lives. We will also introduce our founder, Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue and the various approaches and strategies we practice here at the center. Hi everyone, and welcome to our second episode of 2022. Every year since 1983, Mr. Ikeda has issued an annual peace proposal offering a Buddhist perspective and solutions to global problems. They include specific agendas for strengthening the United Nations, as well as Buddhist principles and ideas that can help ordinary citizens navigate and tackle the many challenges we face, both on a personal and societal level. Every year, all of us at the center study Mr. Ikeda's peace proposals and use it to inform the themes we explore through our programs and events. There's always so much to unpack, so today I invited my colleagues Henri Tanabe and Priyandra Noel to share some highlights from the proposal and what is really resonating with them, especially as we think about this new year and the condition of our world. You may remember them from our end of the year episode, and I'm so happy to have them back again. Before we dive into the discussion, here's a little background on the 2022 peace proposal. This year's proposal is Mr. Ikeda's 40th one, and it is titled Transforming Human History, the Light of Peace and Dignity. In it, he offers concrete ideas for tackling the climate crisis and achieving inclusive education and nuclear disarmament. He also emphasizes the need to address the inequalities the pandemic has exposed, and that gender equality and women's empowerment are key to overcoming the crisis and building a global society that sustains human dignity. Ambassador Anwaru K. Chowdhury, former UN Undersecretary General and High Representative and founder of the Global Movement for the Culture of Peace, comments, quote, "I know of no one who has highlighted the role and responsibility of the United Nations so consistently, relentlessly, and substantively for such a long period of time as President Ikeda. For the last 40 years, his annual peace proposals have contained brilliant ideas and suggestions for the good of humanity. I am encouraged he has highlighted empowerment of people as a major element in building the culture of peace," end quote. So with that, let's welcome Henri and Pri. Hi, Henri and Pri. Welcome back to the Dialogue Studio. I'm so excited to have you both back. I know last time we were here reflecting on 2021 and getting ready for the new year. So it's so great to have you both back so soon. And I, you know, just shared in the introduction, but today we wanted to sort of unpack and share some highlights from Daisaku Ikeda's recent 2022 peace proposal. So I'm really excited to hear your thoughts. I know there's so much in each proposal and I'm like still trying to process everything. So I was wondering maybe for you both, like just in our initial read of the peace proposal, I know, you know, we'll come back to it again and again throughout the year, but just themes that have really stood out to you and that you're thinking about in terms of this new year.
Thanks, Lillian. I think one theme that I really loved from the whole proposal was the fact that, you know, we might be going through certain struggles or challenges throughout the pandemic, but then he also brings to light that many others are suffering even more. Those who are most vulnerable and those who have lost family members and friends, and I'm sure each of us have had experiences that are very challenging to face and know of people who are really struggling. But when I read the whole proposal, I felt like just this sort of empathy for other people and how we can really connect and make sure that, yes, we're struggling, but what about, you know, someone else that is in another country that is in a different situation than us, and how do we continue to like expand our compassion and not just think about, oh, I'm suffering so much with this issue, how do I move forward? But just the feeling that we have to really come together and connect with one another in order to get through the global situation together. So empathy was one that really stood out to me. And I think the one passage that I really liked from this was Mr. Ikeda writes, "The degree of that impact has differed depending on the conditions in which people find themselves. People who are already in vulnerable positions have found their circumstances even more desperate." So I think that in this, he's reminding us that we can't forget about those who have really been impacted the most through this time, and that way forward really needs to address, you know, what flaws are in the system that were built based on not really incorporating those voices of the most vulnerable and marginalized members of society. So yeah, that was one thing that really stood out to me.
Wow, thank you, Henri. And I think to kind of share something along similar lines in regards to the theme is healing and community is something that also really stood out to me in this proposal. But with this underlying theme that's in every peace proposal around the preciousness of life, because as I read, even revisit his other peace proposals, you know, even with nuclear weapons existing, we can make all these great efforts, which we should still continue to do regardless of the impact nuclear weapons has or not. But once we get into any kind of nuclear war, you know, all of that can go to nothing. And just kind of the way he approaches the preciousness of life by taking things into smaller bits and pieces that remind us of like healing at the individual level, making sure we find out everyone, even those who can't do that, are able to do that by also building solidarity and community with this underpinning of don't forget every life is precious. These are three points that really speak to me a lot because it's so easy, especially in this time of the pandemic, to forget to even hold space for the conversation of what the value of our life looks like when we're constantly met with the reality that many people's lives are being lost, whether it is from the coronavirus or war or other things. And so, yes, just this emphasis again on healing together, making sure everyone gets the care they need, as we also strive to eliminate the things that already pose a threat, is always a very eye-opening piece for me. And it's empowering to also just be reminded of how there is one thing you can always passionately fight for in the midst of change. Since he's been writing these peace proposals since, I believe it was 1983, every January 26th, he's out, you know, sharing the many different global issues we can address. It reminds me, like, what is that one thing I can hold on to as I heal in community, as I build solidarity? Those are just some things that came up as I was reading through it this time.
Yeah, thank you, Pri and Henri. Henri, you talked about empathy, and Pri, you talked about healing and community. And I was just sharing this with you both earlier, but one of the parts of the peace proposal that I've been thinking a lot about is in it, Mr. Ikeda talks about this parable or story, and he talks about a disciple of Shakyamuni, who's the historical Buddha. And so the disciple's name is Vimalakirti. And so in this story, Vimalakirti falls sick. And so everybody goes and finds him and they ask him, you know, why are you sick and how long have you been sick and how can we bring about a cure? And Vimalakirti responds and says, you know, because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick. And so it turns out, Mr. Ikeda says that he was not actually suffering from any specific illness. Rather, his empathy, his feelings of shared pain that could not be extinguished so long as others suffered without relief, manifested itself in the form of illness. And then he goes on and he says that the sharing of this pain for Vimalakirti was not something that he experienced as like a weight or burden, but was like evidence that he was continuing to live as his authentic self. So when I read that, I was like, how? You know, because I think one thing I struggled with during the pandemic is sort of like you said, Pri, you know, recognizing that we need to heal together as a community. But then in the morning, I always start the day with reading the news. And sometimes I just like want to cry because I feel so helpless when I like read about people who are suffering so much. And yet I feel like I can't do anything about it. And so sometimes like feeling the pain of others can cause me to feel like almost like powerless in my own life. And so when I read this, I thought, wow, how does this disciple of Shakyamuni feel this sense of like pride almost in being able to share people's sufferings? And then what Mr. Ikeda meant when he said this was evidence that he was living his authentic self. Like, I just have been thinking, what does that really mean? So I was wondering just how you both have navigated empathy and healing in your own life without the burden of like, what if I can't do this, or what if I can't help that person? And maybe in your own perspective, what compassion sort of looks like from Mr. Ikeda's perspective?
Yeah, this is a big question that I'm grateful that you're asking, because I think when I read this parable as well, a couple things came to mind of just when I think of like sickness and health, a lot of times the reality of death comes to mind. And when I think about death, I think a lot about my experiences around it, especially in these times, because having my own experiences around loss, I can see, as much as it's painful, it's the thing that allows me to connect with others who go through similar things. And so when, you know, I read the section talking about how because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick, when I kind of stepped back and tried to like embody what that means, I kind of had this thought of like, just this reminder that even the experiences that in the moment feels very painful or negative, like when there's this heart or spirit to learn from it and create value, like that is ultimately what allows us to connect with others in a world where inevitably we're all going to face some sort of challenges. And so I think there's a lot of compassion for himself and others that Vimalakirti had to be able to see that his sickness was a manifestation of kind of the pulse of the universe or the world around him, which is also within him. And I think it takes a lot of compassion, not just for oneself, but for others, to be able to be like, to be able to not blame someone for something you have no control over. Because I think with a negative mindset, it's so easy to be like, you know, it's your fault that I'm sick because I didn't have access to good food or because I didn't have access to a good healthcare system. But then you flip things around from a Vimalakirti perspective, and it's kind of like, well, the reality is right now I'm sick, whatever that looks like, you know, and the other reality is I still want to live, or I want to transform this into something that gives my life more meaning than this thing that currently has me feeling crippled. And like, though this latter version that I shared is something very hard to embrace, I think there's just this beauty in, yeah, just knowing that I could be a Vimalakirti too, of seeing how, like, how can I embrace all of the world's suffering as my own, but also remember that in me carrying that, I'm not alone, because everyone is striving to do the same as well. I think all that's highlighted when I actually have conversations with others, because I can be having all these thoughts and experiences on my own, but when I don't have the courage to share, especially the painful elements of things, it can feel even more like I'm alone. But then, you know, you call up a really good friend or a family member and you share your struggle. Oftentimes there's someone who understands, whether it's sympathy or empathy can vary, right? Because whether they have or have not yet had the experience will contribute to how they can connect to you. But there are people out there who know, right, what you might be going through. So yeah, all that's to say, I think I just found a lot of value in, especially now more than ever in a time where I still want to isolate more, to choose connection, to kind of embody this compassion and courage and wisdom Vimalakirti had to see that at the time that he did.
Yeah, I really, really thank you, Pri, because I think when you were speaking, I just felt joyful about this story. Not that, you know, I didn't before. I think before I was struggling with it. And then after you shared, I thought, oh, you know, the word interconnectedness came to mind, because I realized, well, for Vimalakirti, like, on one side, it's, oh, he's sick because everybody else is sick and everybody else is suffering. But then, you know, the value creating perspective is that he feels this way because we are all interconnected. So in that sense, you know, even by him becoming healthier, becoming happy, you know, that it can affect someone else as well. So it's almost like the beauty of how we are all interconnected can be like my takeaway from this story. So yeah, I just had a moment of clarity listening to you share, Pri. So thank you. Yeah, Henri, how about you? Because you talked about empathy. Yeah, what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think I love what you both shared about just the importance of really being able to connect with others and understand where they're coming from. And I was just thinking the power of each person to give hope to many other people. Like Lillian, you were saying, if Vimalakirti becomes healthy, then, you know, he is showing an example of someone who is suffering from illness and was able to transform that around. And that can really inspire so many people who are suffering from illness to be able to have an example of someone that was able to overcome it. And there's this one section in the proposal too, where it says, our lives are not possible without the support of many others and the proper functioning of society, and that the deeper joys of life are realized through our connections with others. And when I read that, I also asked myself, like, what during the pandemic made us feel less hope? And I think it was really the disconnect of like not being able to see our friends and family members the way that we used to. But then what made us hopeful was that now we could like connect with people that we hadn't connected with for so long. So I guess one of the things in this example of Vimalakirti is like the ability to give hope to others through our own stories. And I think Mr. Ikeda throughout the proposal gives us these wonderful examples of Vimalakirti or Mr. Makiguchi, Mr. Ikeda's mentor's mentor, and then also Mr. Ikeda's own mentor. And just even the great movements that are happening through the UN and through youth communities that are working to create change, and how much those can serve as a positive example. So I think on the one hand, you know, we can suffer because others are suffering, but there's so much potential to also show that once, you know, we're able to overcome those, that can become a source of hope.
Well, thank you, Henri. I was wondering if there's a particular passage from the proposal that either you're really resonating with or you want to like bring into the rest of the year, and what about the passage spoke to you, just to give our listeners a little inspiration or sneak peek to their own reading of the proposal.
There's so much in here. I wanted to highlight all of it. I was going to bring this really long passage, but I think some of the points we were already able to talk about. So I wanted to share this one section, just one passage, where Mr. Ikeda is talking about, again, like the spirit of not leaving those who are struggling the most behind. And then he says here, in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, the spirit of leaving no one behind tends to be shared spontaneously. However, as reconstruction efforts proceed, it is often the case that this sentiment fades from people's consciousness. Further, the greater the scale of the challenge, as in a pandemic or climate change, the greater the danger that we will remain focused exclusively on the threat. And even though we know it is important not to leave anyone behind, our commitment to do so may weaken over time. In this regard, we should center our efforts on ensuring that those who are exposed to great danger have people in their immediate surroundings on whom they can call for support. So this kind of, I guess, you know, from what we've already talked about of really using this time as kind of like a learning lesson to be able to bring in, you know, the voices of people who have been excluded traditionally or marginalized in the past. And, you know, I think there's also even this part where it says like the pandemic kind of served as like an x-ray, and we're able to see like the fractures that are in society, and that we can't forget that. And I think it's so easy to like, as things go back to some kind of norm, or, you know, our lives pick back up, we kind of forget the experience that we had. And, you know, over time, I think that's a natural kind of human response, because we can't hold on to trauma or pain for a long time. And so, you know, we kind of naturally, as a way of healing and protecting ourselves, forget about, you know, the experiences, the painful experiences that we had. But it's so important to continue having these dialogues where we learn to like reach out to one another when we're suffering. And I just love this last line where he says that it's so important for us to have people in their immediate surroundings on whom they can call for support. And I think through that, you know, we can continue to create these like pockets of hope where, you know, immediately when someone is suffering or, you know, they need help, they're able to call on someone and then regain hope, so that, you know, we don't give up on ourselves and we don't give up on like the future. So yes, I just thought that that part was so beautiful.
I love that. You know, the section that I found really beautiful was actually the one right up above that, kind of highlighting the value of together sharing a sense of joy of being alive. Mr. Ikeda says, when we consider the COVID-19 crisis in the light of this Buddhist perspective, it naturally leads us to question what it means to live in happiness and health at a time when so many people throughout the world are being severely impacted by illness and its accompanying effects. And he further goes on to kind of discuss some things that came up in his conversation with the economist John Kenneth Galbraith. He is a scholar of great renown and someone who had, you know, direct experiences of a number of global crises, including the Great Depression, World War II, and the Cold War. In the dialogue they had in 2003, a sense of truth contained in Professor Galbraith's words for Mr. Ikeda only deepened. And those words are, now more than ever, we need to construct a society where people can confront and together overcome even the most severe challenges. And again, together share a sense of the joy of being alive. And I just think it's so, when I think about not leaving people behind, it's so easy for me to think economically of, like, you know, who doesn't have three meals a day or who doesn't have a roof over their head. But then when I really think about fundamentally, what does all that mean? It always goes back to who's unable to strive for a happy life because they can't even have their basic needs met. And so just this reminder again of, until everyone can really feel like they're on this path of being able to savor each and every moment, there's always someone we're leaving behind, because money doesn't solve problems. Yes, it's nice to have money. It provides luxury and privilege in ways that, you know, not to neglect other things, can provide those luxuries and privileges too. But just this emphasis on, you know, we really need to build a society where everyone can feel that from the depths of their lives. I think that requires, that definitely requires more than just money talk. It's really, why are you unhappy? How can we help you believe you can be happy? And then when you look at all the systems that obstruct people from even genuinely feeling that, I think it opens this conversation of what is it that as a society we need to talk about that politics aren't addressing? Or, yeah, there's just so much, always so much more room to talk about the fundamentals of life, which part of it I think is, you know, how do we live it meaningfully in ways where it's not just like, world peace is peace in my heart. And if I feel like I can't become happy contributing to a larger, more grand scale of peace, I can only imagine it would feel extra difficult. So I just really appreciated that section of, yeah, that determination to leave no one behind on that level too.
I also resonated with many of the parts that you read, and thinking about maybe people who are listening in who don't necessarily work for a peace center or are sort of engaged in the daily work of peace building in the traditional sense. I just wanted to ask a follow-up question to you both. You know, Henri, the section you read about kind of the danger of us like forgetting about those who are suffering. And I even had this thought recently, like, oh my gosh, what if in a year, you know, let's say we go back to sort of more of the previous norm, like we don't have masks anymore, we can gather again. I know how easy it is, like even in a year, to forget that we were in this 2-year shared experience together. And I feel like it will feel like a dream. And I'm so afraid for myself too, to forget the things that, like you said, Henri, you know, the x-ray that Mr. Yukita mentioned that were brought to the surface and that we were beginning to work on changing because it was up in our face like every day and we couldn't avoid it anymore. Like I have this fear that as a society, we'll go back to just sort of the way we were before. And you also read Mr. Yukita where he says that it's so important for people to have in their immediate surroundings someone they can call for support. And so I was just wondering, like, what does that look like for you both in your own life or even for someone who is just struggling with their day-to-day? How do you feel we can all do that?
I think something that the pandemic has highlighted for me is how easy it was for me to not share my struggles. Like, it was easier always to put on a mask in the sense that my obstacles weren't weighing me down so much so to the extent that I couldn't move forward. So there was a part of me that's like, well, you know, just do whatever therapeutic thing you do to kind of overcome it on your own. And like, I always used to kind of leave it at that. Not that I didn't have conversations with my friends or family about the things I'm going through, but I feel like in this pandemic, the degree or the extent to which I really allow those who love and care about me to dive deeper into my struggles have changed. And I feel like there's a peace building element of that, of allowing people to really get to know you by like having the courage to be like, my mountain might be your hill and your mountain might be my hill, but knowing that I, in respecting my life and my happiness, I shouldn't minimize my obstacle, and to not minimize it and instead celebrate and work through it. The more beautiful way to do it, as opposed to doing it on your own, is to do it like with someone you trust. And I think I've kind of neglected the element of that in peace building because it's so easy to think of the abstract of like, I have to do all these big things and show that I'm strong so that people don't think like I'm a crybaby. Because in reality, I'm a crybaby. I like, there's probably not a day that I don't cry. And I think in this society, it's so easy to misconstrue that as like, oh my gosh, I'm weak. I have to like not show this side of myself. But now more than ever, when it's very apparent that like the weight of death and grief is heavy, when we don't talk about it, I think it further prevents us from going towards this path of peace and happiness because there's something we're always bottling up out of fear or whatever that, you know, it will only like amplify the heaviness we feel as opposed to like, wow, like I didn't think that person was experiencing this too until like this person had the courage to say it. And to kind of start putting a ribbon at the end of my my spiel here, one particular example for me is, so my mom passed away in 2017, and this was like way before the pandemic, right? And I think for many years there was a lot of this, you know, it impacted my life, but life still goes on. So I felt like I had to keep, I'm getting a little emotional just speaking about this, but I think it's important, so I'm going to share it. But just this feeling of, oh, I shouldn't talk about it because I don't want other people to feel bad for me or like pity for me. But then in me not talking about it, it doesn't help me process my grief. So in a time where, you know, the pandemic, so many people are losing so many more people at a rate that we can't quite prepare for, I found value in like openly talking about things that even, what is it, 5 years later, I'm still processing as a step towards really feeling united and connected with other people who are struggling ever more deeply with things like grief and death that have always been here, but just ever more present. So yeah, that's been very helpful for me. Sharing your struggles and don't second guess yourself for doing it because everyone's going through something. And just because they can't relate to it, it doesn't mean it's not worthy of being shared. In fact, in you introducing something to someone that you're going through allows them to at least sympathize with someone else who might be going through that because they know of the experience. People can still vicariously live through you. So yes, that's something I'm learning a lot. And as you can tell, as I cry, it's still hard to do, but I think it's like so important. So yes, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Pri. Yeah, for just having the courage to share that with all of us and with everybody who's listening too. And there's a part of the peace proposal where Mr. Ikeda shares the words of Nelson Mandela. And I don't know why when you were sharing it reminded me of that section where Nelson Mandela said that one of the challenges of our time is to reinstill in the consciousness of our people that sense of human solidarity, of being in the world for one another and because of and through others. And I think just like, that's so beautiful what you shared, Pri, that just by you showing up as your authentic self, like that creates a space for somebody else to do the same. And though we're all different and we might have different experiences, that creates like the human solidarity, you know, that we're all human beings living in this world with these, whether experiences of loss and grief or experiences of joy, but if we can share them with each other, you know, we connect on those, not like everything else that in the world that, you know, that is going wrong. So I really appreciate everything that you've shared. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Pri, and thank you, Lillian, for sharing. I was really thinking about the importance of sharing yourself with others and not like putting up this wall, because we never know what part of your experience will resonate with others. And I was thinking, to answer your question, Lillian, about, you know, what we can do as people, maybe not immediately, you know, changing policies or in the realm of like peace building, that we think is like in a big way. But I think each of us has like such a great ability to transform the environment that we are in. So I thought of my old coworker when I used to work at a university, and we worked with many students, and she always like took so much time to listen to the stories of the students, of, you know, where they were coming from, what their financial situation was like, what was it like when they, you know, went home in a, like, home as in like, you know, they would move from a foreign country to this brand new environment, and then they would be given like pages and pages of homework, and, you know, they're like tackling on so much, and then they're far away from their families, and, you know, something could be going on with their families back home. And so I think she just made it such a point to really get to know each student first and where they were at. And I think that made like such a tremendous difference in each of those students' lives. And in that way, like that's a form of like peace building and being able to support someone who, you know, maybe are like, okay, this is too difficult, but all they really needed was someone to say like, it's going to be okay and that they can do it. And so I think that in creating those like relationships and being able to support one another in that way, and we need people like that everywhere, you know, not just in politics or in medicine or, you know, I think in every field, it's so important that educators, you know, it's and Mr. Ikeda talks about like just young people too, and how much young people are suffering right now through the uncertainties of the pandemic, and that many of them feel hopeless. But it's our responsibility in every relationship that we have. We're able to believe in an individual's potential when they feel like giving up, and that can transform, you know, the trajectory of their lives. So this made me think of that.
What you shared about caring for another person and like asking about their lives, it reminded me of recently, for our listeners, we hosted this mini dialogue on an upcoming virtual dialogue nights that will be on the topic of burnout. And so some of our youth committee members came together to have a discussion around burnout and actually the power of connection. And Pri, you reminded me of this interaction as well. One of the youth members had shared, you know, that she had lost her mother recently. And then another youth committee member sort of unmuted right away and thanked her for sharing and, you know, expressed that she doesn't have that experience, but appreciates her like sharing that with everybody in this space. And actually this youth committee member messaged me on the side and sort of was wondering if it was okay for her to ask and share that, like she wasn't sure if her response was appropriate. And before I could even respond, the youth committee member who lost her mother right away shared with her, you know, you may not have had the same experience of losing your mother, but maybe you've experienced grief in other ways. And maybe that's a point of us being able to connect. And then, you know, this kind of became this beautiful dialogue between the two of them. And just what you both shared, yeah, just reminded me of that interaction, to have the courage to be with each other and to be vulnerable with each other, which sort of brings me to one of the final questions of our podcast today. I know we could probably do another 2 or 3 episodes just on this year's proposal, but I feel like dialogue seems to be a theme that has come up just through our discussion, or the need for dialogue in being able to really actualize some of the things that Mr. Ikeda talks about in this proposal. So I was just wondering for you both, what role do you think dialogue plays in all of the things we just talked about? And in what ways do you see us being able to take parts of this proposal and sort of put it into practice in our events throughout this year?
That's a great question, Lillian. Every year, Mr. Ikeda focuses one section of the peace proposal on nuclear disarmament and how crucial that is. And in the 2022 proposal, he does the same. And he quotes a speech from Professor Galbraith that Pri mentioned earlier as well, the economist. And when asked like what advice he would give at the end of his book, he talked about nuclear abolition and how that was a crucial part of like really the future of society. And I'll just read this one part. He says, "If we fail in the control of the nuclear arms race, all of the other matters we debate in these days will be without meaning. There will be no question of civil rights, for there will be no one to enjoy them. There will be no problem of urban decay, for our cities will be gone. So let us disagree, I trust, with good humor on the other issues, but let us agree that we will tell all of our countrymen, all of our allies, all human beings, that we will work to have an end to this nuclear horror that now hovers as a cloud over all humankind." And as I was reading this, this section, I just thought, like, how are we gonna, you know, stop the use of nuclear weapons? And I think it's really why Mr. Ikeda emphasizes dialogue so much. I think because it is really only going to be through dialogue with people in order to come to this consensus that we have to stop allowing these weapons to exist on this earth. And so, yes, your question regarding just like what is the importance of dialogue, I just, when I read that section, I felt that is the only method, you know, to achieve peace. And so I know we talk about how like dialogue is the way for peace, but in this section, I just felt like it was so serious and so crucial that we continue to engage in these dialogues. And maybe not every conversation will be about nuclear abolition right away, but it's through the relationships that we build and these connections that we build with others that we're able to kind of get to this place of like empathy and really understanding that this is something we have to like reach a consensus on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Henri. In addition to what you just shared, there's a section where Mr. Ikeda highlights Mr. Makiguchi's perspective around the great good that members of society can perform. And just to read what he stressed was, in fact, it is not the size or scale of one's actions that matters. If you could save someone's life by giving them a glass of water, would this not be something that no amount of money can buy? In this example, we can sense Makiguchi's conviction that value is not found in things, but in relations. And the relation piece really makes me think of dialogue, because I think of just all these atrocities that whether we see on the news or hear from a friend, there's often this question of, oh, I wonder, you know, why this person did that thing? Did they not have someone they could turn to? Or why did this situation happen? There's just all these what if questions, I think, that oftentimes goes back to if there was someone they could turn to, like a friend, lending an ear to just talk through the shared feelings of, I don't like the way the world is right now, how big of a difference that can make, how it really can be giving a glass of water, you know, to someone who really needs it. Because I think the more aware we become of ourselves and the world around us, we're going to feel disappointed by a lot of things that maybe doesn't feel like has progressed very much so, even if it has. But to really grasp an understanding of the progress we are making towards peace, to be able to talk about things at the most local level of this is how I'm feeling, and kind of challenging and believing in the good of humanity to even trust someone that you only might see once and never again. I think the more everyone does that through acknowledging and holding space for the power of dialogue, the more even something as big as getting rid of nuclear weapons could really be a thing, because everyone can really believe it in their encounters that, oh, this is not just something I'm wishing for, but I'm hoping for it, and there are other people hoping for it too, which Mr. Ikeda says hope is a decision. So I think dialogue always gives space for us to remember that.
Yes, thank you both so much. Pri and Henri, both of you reminded me of Mr. Ikeda's quote on dialogue, and I share this quote often, but he talks about it as this painstaking and persistent effort to remove all obstacles that obscure our common humanity. And so just like when I was listening to both of you share about dialogue, it made me think dialogue, it's almost like a choice to, it's a decision to have hope. Because I feel like when we have dialogue, I realize lately I've been having some difficult conversations, and I realize that sometimes I don't want to engage in dialogue because I don't want to challenge kind of my pessimism or like my negativity about the world. Because I realize like if I do engage, there always is hope, because there's a possibility that how I feel about the world is not actually the reality. And then to have the courage to accept that there is something that I can do and that there is hope for a better future, I think sometimes makes me scared, you know, that no, I don't want to take that responsibility, or like, no, I don't want to do that work. But when we engage, it's like anything that causes us to not believe in us and our humanity, like, gets removed, you know. So I just appreciate that so much. And I have one final question. I know I didn't ask you about this beforehand, so whatever comes to mind, and just because we're on the topic of dialogue and you both just shared such beautiful ways that we can engage in our daily life, just thinking about your lives now and like your current struggles and your work at the center, what kind of dialogues are you both looking forward to having this year? Or like what aspects of dialogue even do you want to challenge or that you want to do more of?
Yeah, that's great. I guess one thing is, as I was reading this peace proposal, I felt like my own pessimism too. Just feeling like, wow, I don't really believe in the power and potential of my life the way that Mr. Ikeda is writing about it here. You know, that absolute, like, no matter what, you know, humans are the ones who can determine the direction of history. And So I really want to challenge having dialogues that are more hopeful, I think, because for me, sometimes I like engage in, it's not really a dialogue, I guess, if we're just like complaining about the reality of the situation, which is like, you know, it's nice. It's a nice way to like, you know, just share what we're feeling, but how do we kind of lift each other up more? And I think in order to do that, we have to really like believe in it ourselves, that there is hope for the future. So I guess that's, yeah, that's one way I would like to challenge my own negativity too, I guess, similarly to what you shared, Lillian, not staying in a place of just hopelessness.
I think an area where I want to challenge dialogue is on a similar front. I think this year I've shied away a little bit from having more open-hearted dialogues, just because I get so in my head about how what I say might burden someone in this way, or I'm too much. But then in talking with some friends, I realize maybe my sense of feeling that I'm too much to other people is also kind of highlighting how much more room there is for me to fill myself more with this feeling of like, you're enough and worthy to share yourself. And so after being posed this question by you, I think I want to engage in more dialogue, because I think facing myself, especially in the context of other people, has been like extra intense. It feels a little intimidating when I feel like I'm about to share something about my life that I haven't even personally had a dialogue about with myself. Or if I have, I haven't even come to a conclusion about it. But the beauty of dialogue is, like, you can come back to it many times. You don't have to know, right? So for me to not choose it means I'm holding on to pessimism. So I want to choose it so that I could also re-channel even more, you know, the sense of hope that we still can choose to have. And so I am determined to have these kinds of conversation with at least 5 people, like maybe, you know, increasing how many of those interactions I have even on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to, like, you know, once a month is good enough. No. Right now, I think we need to have at least one every day or every other day. So I want to choose dialogue. Refresh my determination in choosing dialogue.
Yes, I love that, Pri. A dialogue a day keeps the, what is it? Keep it away?
Keeps the doctor away. I guess it's like the apple a day, but I don't know if you do dialogue. Keeps the pessimism away.
I guess doctors are good, so we shouldn't say keep the doctors away. But I thank you both so much, and I think it's so encouraging that all 3 of us work at a dialogue center. We are struggling with the same aspect of having dialogue. So I really see this as a cause we're making, all 3 of us, to have hopeful dialogues this year. So for anyone who's listening, you know, even though we talk about dialogue every day, it's still not easy, but we're going to do it together. So this is just reassurance from all 3 of us. So thank you for tuning in. And Pri and Anri, thank you again for joining today. And yeah, I hope to have you back soon.
So that's all we have time for today. And I hope you enjoyed learning a little bit more about Mr. Ikeda's 2022 peace proposal. And we would love to hear what stood out to you after your own reading of it. You can find the proposal on daisakuikeda.org, and I'll also include a link to it in the episode description. Some themes that Anri and Pri shared really stayed with me. First is this idea of empathy, and that in times when we are suffering the most, if we remember that there are others struggling as well, or even in worse situations, we can bring forth the determination to not only transform our own difficulties, but help others as well. Pri's courage to share her experience of losing her mom inspired me to be more vulnerable with others and reminded me of the power of sharing our stories as a way to heal both for ourselves and others. Finally, all 3 of us realized that the times when we brought forth courage to engage in genuine dialogue with others, we were able to turn our pessimism into a decision to have hope. Through dialogue, we remember that we are all interconnected and that we all have something unique to contribute to the world. Well, thank you for tuning in to the Dialogue Studio today. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we will be reflecting on burnout, the power of connections, and our first virtual dialogue nights of the year. If you are interested in learning more about the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue, you can visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Also, don't forget to email us at podcast@ikedacenter.org if you have any questions or would like to share any of your dialogue stories with us. Thank you, everyone, and happy dialoguing!